Welcome to Radio Oldies, sponsored by Baillie Gifford Actual Investors. Looking beyond today's headlines, Baillie Gifford backs exceptional companies driving progress and helping investors benefit from long-term growth. Hello, I'm Charlotte Metcalf, and my guest today is Michael Rosen, the multi-award-winning children's author and poet, and one of our best-known voices as the presenter of BBC Radio 4's Word of Mouth. His YouTube channel has 900,000 subscribers and has attracted 164 million views. The former Children's Laureate, he's the Professor of Children's Literature at Goldsmiths College, has written 200 books and counting and is held in great affection and admiration by anyone interested in encouraging children and young people to read. He turned 80 in May, but shows zero signs of slowing down. He's celebrating his birthday by touring with a new live show and has an upcoming collection of poetry called The Weirdest Thing of All. His latest book, Where Are You, Eddie, was published in March. Michael Rosen, a very warm welcome to Radio Oldie.
Thanks for having me, Charlotte.
Well, it's a complete pleasure. And can we start with Where Are You, Eddie? Your recent and very moving book, beautifully illustrated, about your son, Eddie, who died, as many people who know you will know, suddenly and unexpectedly in 1999, aged just 18, from meningitis. Now, extraordinarily, the book's publication coincided with the alarming recent meningitis outbreak in Kent. Now, you wrote about Eddie's death in the absolutely brilliant The Sad Book, with illustrations by Quentin Blake, back in 2011. So I'm just wondering what prompted you to write again about your feelings 15 years on.
I think, Charlotte, it was because, to a certain extent, my feelings had changed. When I wrote The Sad Book, it was very, very, very raw.
Yes.
I just felt overwhelmed, and I wanted to express for myself, really, how I felt overwhelmed. The feelings that led to Where Are You, Eddie? It's more the fact that to accept the fact that Eddie hasn't died. Now, that might seem just absolutely crazy, but I'm now of a feeling that Eddie hasn't gone, that he's everywhere. He's in other people's memories. He's in my memories. So instead of thinking all the time, Eddie's not here, Eddie's gone, I think now much more that Eddie's with me, and he's with his brothers and sisters, he's with his mum, and he's beyond. He's in with his old friends and the people he played hockey with and all that. And I wanted to express that, and I sort of tried to feel around a way of saying it. And I rather like cats, and Eddie liked cats, and cats liked Eddie. And suddenly one of our cats now kind of spoke to me. I mean, I don't mean that I was looking at Meg, our cat, and she actually spoke, but I just suddenly felt Meg could be, if you like, a muse, or more like a kind of mythic figure who could talk to me and explain just the thoughts that I've just had now. So rather than these thoughts that I've just expressed to you coming out of my mouth, the cat can express them to me. So I have that dialogue with Meg the cat in the book, and Meg is basically saying, go out, have a look, and I find Eddie, in inverted commas, out there, and in that way Eddie is still alive, and I come back and the cat's kind of, yeah, you see, I told you, kind of knowing horrible way in which cats are. They seem to know a lot, don't they?
They do.
Kind of nod, you know.
Sagely.
Like, exactly. I told you so look on their face. And then she confides in me, which is rather lovely. Meg says, well, you know, Eddie, you know, used to like me and used to tickle and stroke me too. So there's a nice way in which, there's that way in which it sort of comes round again to the cat and me.
I think what's so brilliant about this book is that I think there's been such an awful spate of... I know so many people who've lost children, who've taken their own lives, you know, in the last few years. And for their brothers and sisters, I think it's such a lovely way of talking to young people about you haven't lost, you know, they haven't gone.
Yes, I mean, obviously, the very first feelings you have, it feels like... you know, you can find any analogies, but it feels like an amputation. It feels like something's been pulled away from your life. Mm. There's this great hole, this great gap. And, you know, we have gatherings every year to commemorate Eddie's death, and we all meet up. And the first two or three years, all I could think of is he's not here. And as the years have progressed, in fact, it's you know, paradoxically, it's a presence, not an absence.
Yes, yes. Can we talk a bit about meningitis?
Because yes.
Tell us a bit about what actually happened, because it was so horrifically sudden and every parent's sort of worst nightmare.
Yes, well, I mean, doctors can correct me on this, but, you know, you can get meningitis in a variety of ways, put it that way. And one way, and the best route for survival, if it happens that way, is purely swelling of the meninges, which are the membranes on around the brain. So if that's, quote, all that happens, then there's a good chance of survival. The big problems arise if the meningitis bacterium crosses the membranes in the throat, because the bacterium sits in the throat. If the bacterium crosses the membrane into the blood, then you've got only a few hours, because what happens is effectively you die of sepsis. Mm. So what happened with Eddie was that he was ill. He had what, you know, a parent looking at an 18-year-old thought, oh, well, that looks like flu, something flu-y. So I dosed him he had ibuprofen.
Calpol or something.
Yeah, paracetamol, and said, you know, sort yourself out. After all, he'd virtually left home. And he went to bed. I poked my head round just before I went to bed, and he was just lying there. I said, good night, Eddie. And then when I went in the morning at about 6, because I was off to work somewhere, he was dead. I mean, what happened was I went over to him and said, Eddie, I'm off now. And then there was a split second where I think I knew there was something wrong. And I went, Eddie, Eddie, and shouted, and he didn't respond. And then I felt him.
Oh, Michael. Oh.
And he felt cold. And then I immediately rang 999, and they said, pull him from the bed and put him on his side. And as he hit the floor, some fluid came out of his mouth. I can remember that. And I said, I've done that. And they said, we're coming round. And they appeared to come round in like 50 seconds. It can't have been that. They must have come round in about 4 or 5 minutes or something. And I can see these great bulky paramedics rushing into the house and into the room. And in a split second, they said, he's dead.
So meningitis now has become, you know, it's a real thing of yours, isn't it, to help people understand what it is and to fight it. And it's extraordinary that your book was published sort of during that terrifying outbreak in Kent, when we all suddenly ring up our doctors and saying, is there a vaccine?
Yeah, and again, you know, the experts will be better on this than me. The point is that when Eddie died, he wouldn't have died if he'd had the vaccine, the A and C vaccine. He died of meningitis C.
He wouldn't have died if he'd had that.
So the vaccine was available, but it wasn't statutory. It wasn't going around for everybody.
It should be.
And it hadn't been. I went onto the radio saying that.
Yeah.
And the chief medical officer of health at the time, he said, I'm not going to be bumped into making this vaccine universally available.
Why?
Well,
why not?
I don't know. I was only listening to the radio at that point. And I thought, well, goodness me. But 6 months later, they did.
Mm.
But, of course, it was 6 months too late for Eddie. Mm. But meanwhile, there's a danger for meningitis B, because meningitis takes different forms. So the vaccines struggle to keep up with the different forms.
Yes.
So the people who died
in Kent,
and there was another place, wasn't there?
Yeah.
They died of meningitis B. Why? Because meningitis B has now become available. They are giving it to babies. But why? Because there's what I call a meningitis gap. Mm. That's to say, there's a gap between those who got it, who are getting it at birth, and those who didn't.
Right.
And the gap, because by and large, you don't get meningitis past 20, 21, 22.
Yes.
The key danger areas are under fives and this 17 to 22 age group. And those people who died or got meningitis in this recent outbreak, what I would call, they were in the gap between the time it wasn't available and the time between it became available. So there are people out there, possibly 200,000 people, young people between those ages, who are vulnerable because they haven't got the MenB vaccine.
Gosh.
So I would say go and get it.
Up to what age? I mean, under what age?
Well, I would say under 23.
Yeah, I've got a 22-year-old, so I'm going straight home to yank her to the doctor.
Exactly. Because they wouldn't have had it at birth, you see, because the statutory, it was not statutory, well, anyway, when they implemented it, it was too late for your child, for your offspring. Yeah.
Gosh. Okay, well, I'm going straight home to sort that out. Thank you, Michael.
No, I'm happy to pass that on.
Now, you are no stranger to extreme illness yourself, because you nearly died of COVID. Can you, 48 days in induced coma, was it?
48 days in intensive care, about 40 days in an induced coma.
Tell us what happened.
My gag is, I don't know, do I? Because I was in a coma. what happened? So this is March 2020, before vaccines. Before anyone really quite
knew what it was. Right at the beginning.
Oh, yes.
Right at the very start of it all. Yeah.
This felt like flu. I felt flu-y. The only thing was, I was getting weaker and weaker, and I was crawling to the loo. I was thinking, why can't I, normally when I have flu, I kind of stagger to the loo and hold the walls, you know what I mean, when you have a bad flu. And instead I was crawling, and I thought, that's weird. And then the other thing that was weird, I said to Emma, it's my wife, I said, can you open the window? And she said, the window is open. I said, because I can't, I feel like when I breathe in, I can't catch up. So we rang the paramedics, and the paramedic said, will you breathe down the phone? So I breathed down the phone, and then he said, do you feel worse than you do yesterday? And I said, no, not really. Perhaps I should have said yes, because I didn't. Then he said, will you cough? So I went, and he said, well, you haven't got COVID. Right?
No.
Yes, God, yes. No, and that happened twice.
Anything about it then, did they?
That happened twice. Gosh. And then Emma came in and looked at me, and I think, well, the way she expressed it is that you looked like you were dying. So luckily, we have a friend, a neighbour who is a GP, and Katie came over, and luckily she had with her an oximeter, this little apparatus that many of us now know about, but at the time we didn't know. It's the crocodile clip onto the finger to find out your oxygen saturation. So Emma put it on my finger, and Dr. Katie said, what does it read? And Emma said, 58.
What's it meant to be?
95. Dr. Katie froze and said, quick, get him to the hospital now. And afterwards, when she was writing it down, first of all, she said she'd never seen anyone conscious with a sat level that low. You're on the way out at 58.
Oh, my goodness.
And she said, if she hadn't been there at that moment, I would have gone that night.
Well, aren't we lucky to have you with us still?
Yes.
And so perky. Do you think the fact you've had to confront your mortality, you know, in such a big way like that, has made you as energetic as you are today? You know, because you're doing so much.
People do often ask me that. I don't think so. I mean, I suppose from the outside, it looks like I'm being a bit urgent. Like, and that's what it looks like, but it doesn't feel like that. It just feels like I'm enjoying this stuff, so why don't I do it? I mean, I know I'm on the last legs. I'm on hitting the deadline. Last chapter. All those expressions we got. But then at the same time, I just think, well, if I can do these things and people want me to do these things, let's do them.
So what a brilliant segue, to use a horrible word, into your tour. Tell us about that.
I'm touring all over the country, doing performances. I mean, they're billed as family shows, and there's kind of the usual sort of age group suitable for the over sevens, you know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But there is something odd going on. I arrive and I look at the audience, provided it's, you know, with the lights up, and in the audience, there's anything up to about 50% of the people are, shall we say, elderly.
Oldies.
Oldies without children.
Gosh.
And I'm thinking, why have you come? And I don't really know the answer. I haven't asked. I haven't dared ask yet. But as I look across and I'm asking the audience to go through the gestures, you know, hands on the bridge, feel the rhythm of the train. Hands on the window, feel the rhythm of the rain. You know, I'm doing all the gestures. And I look across and say, join in, everybody. And there's all the kiddies there. I can see them all around the audience, all joining in. And then these oldies.
The oldest start joining in.
Well, they don't start off with. And I think, well, as you've come, I
come
said,
on
I
now.
Can, I, come on now. So I say, that's okay, you've got permission. You don't have to sit there with your arms firmly by your side. Join in, and sure enough, they do. You know, if you go to a stand-up and you're an older person, you're going to be confronted with stand-ups talking about their penises, their vaginas, their defecation, and, you know, it's all very funny. But if you're in your 60s and 70s, you might think, well, I don't really want to spend 20 quid to go and watch someone talking about, you know, the last time they had sex. Which, I do quite enjoy, but but maybe if I come along, there's this bloke, Michael Rosen, he's going to do Down Behind the Dustbin. I met a dog called Jim. He didn't know me, and I didn't know him. And you can join in and have a bit of a laugh, and it's sort of, you know, and you can be pretty sure. Well, 1,000% sure I will not be talking about penises and vaginas.
You mentioned YouTube there. Can we talk about that for a minute? Because obviously you have this massive following. What do you think about the upcoming ban? Because while on the one hand, you know, YouTube's such a double-edged sword, isn't it? Because you, who are all about encouraging children to read and love books, you could argue that YouTube's terribly bad for that. So what do you think about the ban, and how's it going to affect your channel?
Not at all, you'll be pleased to know, because we're in a ghetto. So we're YouTube Kids. So YouTube Kids is unaffected by bans and whatever. And schools, I think, will still be able to use it. And almost every video, I'm talking about books.
Yes.
So I'm saying this poem comes from this book, or I'm saying here's the latest books that I've done, or I'm interviewing other writers, Francesca Simon or David Armand. And so it's very heavily book-oriented. I'm acknowledging that we live in, as the jargon puts it, the intermediate world, or the multimodal world. In other words, we have live performances, we have books, we have the internet, we have telly, we have radio. And, you know, I occupy a space, if you like, using all those things.
You're like a Venn diagram.
Yes, that's Venn diagram. Right. There we are. Let's do our Venn diagram. But this is me doing one foot hand over the other. yes. So I think, as far as our YouTube, I have to say our, because my son is the director of it. It was all his idea. He is the father of my YouTube channel. He is 50, so he is definitely a child father to the man, as Wordsworth put it. He invented it. He looks after it. He directs it. When I say, why don't we do this? He says, no, Dad, you've got the wrong end of the stick. So, he's in charge of it, very much so.
You've had six children, is that right? Including
I had
Eddie,
or five biologicals and two steps. Uh-huh. So lost one and acquired two. Yes. Yes. So, you know, good swap.
Can we go back to your childhood for a minute? Because your parents were passionate educators, weren't they? And tell us a bit about your parents. And you grew up in Harrow, is that right?
Yeah, in Pinner. Which is the London Borough of Harrow now. Yeah. Yes, and it was quite odd that we were living in Pinner. They were Jewish East Enders, so they came from London's East End. My dad was actually born in the States, came to this country when he was two. So he lived in behind the Royal London Hospital in Nelson Street. Mm-hmm. And my mum lived just a bit up the road in Bethnal Green, mm-hmm, in Globe Road. And they met when they were about 15 or 16. And I've sort of figured it out that the Great Battle of Cable Street, as it's called, when the Jewish East End, along with many other East Enders and other people, sat in the street, basically, occupied the street to prevent Oswald Mosley, leader of the British Union of Fascists, from entering, and that was their first date.
Brilliant.
Yes, that's right, so more or less.
United in protest.
Exactly, and they stayed together until my mum died when I was 30 and she was only 56.
Oh no, how did she die?
She died of cancer. And so my dad was utterly desolate from that experience. And they lost a child as well, so he lost a baby brother. He lost a baby and I lost a child. So we had a lot to talk about, me and my dear dad. Yeah. Yes, he lived till he was 89.
And you were very close to him till the end.
Very, very close, yes, that's right. He was quite an extraordinary guy, an educationist, writer, scholar, philosopher, linguist. Taught language and literature in education.
After a spell at wanting to be a doctor, you went to Oxford, didn't you, and read English?
That's right, yes. It was one of those things where I made the terrible mistake of saying to my Jewish parents that I liked biology.
Oh dear, so he's going to be a doctor.
Exactly. They looked at him and said, you could be a doctor. And I guess it was a form of vanity in which I thought, yeah, I can do anything. You know, yeah, I can. I do languages. Yes, I love English and all the rest of it. But I could, yeah. And they took me to get, see a doctor friend of theirs who said that at this time there was something called First MB, where you could go in with zero science qualifications, and in a year they built you up to about A-level science so that you could then go on to do a medical training. And so I did that at the Middlesex Hospital Medical School, and I started getting cold feet. I thought, this is not really me. I was drowning, and so I cooked up a ruse that if my brother was at Wadham College, Oxford, that if I could get into Oxford, my brother had once explained to me, unknowingly, that it's very easy to change course at Oxford. So I hatched this plan to go to Oxford. And they accepted me, thinking I was going to do medicine. I did do a year and then pleaded with my parents and with the principal to change, and they let me. That's how I ended up doing English for another 3 years. So,
what did you do after Oxford, immediately after Oxford? And how long ago had you started writing before then?
Oh, I'd started writing when I was about 15 or 16.
Really? For children or...?
I was writing for my contemporaries, mm-hmm. And getting it printed in school magazine.
Oh.
So that was rather lovely. I remember writing a dramatic monologue in the style of Robert Browning. Very pretentious, but it sounds like it, but it wasn't at all. The teacher, Miss Grant, came in and said, today we're going to do dramatic monologues. And we did that one as That's My Last Duchess.
On the wall, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, we loved that one.
And I just thought this was magic. I mean, I really did. So I was all excited by all that. That was the first one. Then I did a poem in sort of imitation of D.H. Lawrence. I loved the little cycle of poems he did. Snake, Bat,
wonderful.
Man and Bat. Yeah. And I did one. I called it Moth, you see. And so I was in the bedroom. I can just see myself standing there. And a moth came in and I killed it. You see? Sorry about that. And then I thought, oh, I could write a poem about that. And I'd be disgusted with myself for killing the moth, because it's only a moth. What did I kill it for?
Were you getting published at this point?
Well, in the school magazine.
Because when you had a play on at the Royal Court, so was that...
That was when I was at university. That was when I was about 18... No, it must be a bit older. 90.
That's quite a huge feat.
Yeah, well, I had a 2-week run of Backbone, as it was called. So that was a very nice and wonderful thing.
Was that for children or not?
No, that's an adult play.
Yes, that's
right. Yeah, very much so. But it, in a strange way, it kind of dislocated me, because I was sort of cross that it was successful. It's a very weird feeling.
Very interesting, yeah.
I think I was almost too young to have had that success, because I didn't... Mm. It wasn't that I was overwhelmed by the success, it was more that I was sort of irritated by it. It's very difficult to explain. And also people say, well, what are you writing next? And I thought, well, I haven't got anything else to write about, because I haven't had any experience.
So what made the big change? I mean, what was the moment in which you became so known for what you do now so brilliantly?
Well, the first book for children came out in 74, but as it happens, the poems that I'd written for that book, I thought were kind of wry observations of childhood that adults would be interested in.
Oh, that's interesting.
But the publisher who published the play, Fabers, didn't like them. And thought they were kind of arch, I think. And then we gave it to the children's publisher, Wing of Fabers. And I remember the woman there said, they're too much in the pretend voice of the child. And I remember thinking, well, that's weird, because the two great famous volumes for children, Robert Louis Stevenson's A Child Garden of Verses and Now We're Seven by A.M. Milne, yes, are both in the voice of a child written by adults. In the end, a very nice woman called Pam Royds, an independent publisher called Andre Deutsch, which doesn't exist anymore, she liked them very much, married me up with Quentin Blake.
Stroke of genius.
Which was wonderful. I remember going in there and acting out the poems in the room with him there, and he sat there with a great big piece of paper in front of him, drawing until he filled this great big piece of paper with maybe 30, 40 little vignettes of me doing this, but it wasn't me as an adult. He was translating me into a child because I was acting it out. And that was wonderful. So that was the first book, 74. And the children's book world is very, very welcoming.
That's so interesting.
If you produce a book in the children's book world, there are schools, libraries, teacher training colleges saying, come in, quick, come in, talk about what you do. Come and talk to the children. And suddenly I was touring. I was going around the country doing gigs in schools and discovering how to do it as well, because to start off with, I was very pompous. You know, I'd go in and hold the book in front of my face and go, the ship in the dock was at the end of the trip, the man on board was the captain of the ship, you know, and quickly realising that the children were bored stiff until you acted out the poems. And I learnt that from, in fact, a deputy head at a Northwest London school. And I remember him saying, well, the children are ready for you, Michael. And I thought I was going to see 20 children and do this sort of, down behind the dustbin, I met a dog called Jip, you know, sort of radio voice kind of hiding behind a book thing. And he opened the door and there was the whole school. And I remember thinking, gasping, 400 children. And he said, boys and girls, Michael Rosen. And there was this great roar that kind of almost sort of sent me back against the wall, you know, Michael Rosen, like this. And then he said, over to you, Michael. And I remember holding up the book and reading this poem, which, and London kids will give you about 9 seconds.
Correct.
You know, and suddenly their Velcro gets really interesting. And Mr. McElhane, Sean McElhane, said he looked from me to the children and he knew he had a problem. And he went, no, it doesn't go like that, does it, boys and girls? And they all stared at him and went, no, shall we show Michael Rosen how it goes? And they went, yes. And then he danced the poem. I jest not. I could see him going, the ship in the docks at the end of the trip. I'm dancing, listeners.
And he
the man
is
on
dancing,
board
listeners.
Is the captain of the ship. The name of the man is old Ben Brown, and he plays the ukulele with his trousers down. Anyway, and I remember thinking, oh, is that what you do?
That's a life-changing moment.
Oh, totally. Totally. And the daft thing is that all through university and all through my, between the ages of 11 and 15, when I'd been doing the Young Questers in Ealing, I'd learnt how to do all this acting stuff, but I'd never applied it to poetry. I thought poetry was, I wondered,
a solemn
lonely,
thing.
Well, you know, you had it, what did you have in your ear? You had
W.H. Auden, well, and T.S. Eliot.
T.S. Eliot, a cold coming we had of it.
Dreadful.
Well, it is and it isn't. I like it in its own way.
But not for kids.
But, you know, if you stand in front of 400 primary school children and just say, a cold coming we had of it,
no way.
Then you lose them. But if you do what Sean McElhane did and dance a poem, and I suddenly could marry all that, you know, all the acting and funny sketch stuff I'd been doing at Questers and at Oxford and so on, with the reading of poetry. And then I thought, yeah, I get it. Life-changing moment, exactly as you say, Charlotte.
So that's why YouTube became such an important outlet for you.
Yeah.
Because,
exactly. That's what Joe, my son, credit
genius.
To him.
Genius,
He looked at me and said, Dad, we could put this stuff on YouTube. I said, what's YouTube? I mean, seriously, I didn't
know.
How
long ago was that? What date was that?
I think he put Bear Hunt out first.
Oh, Bear Hunt, yeah.
And I think that maybe as long ago as 2007.
And when you became Poet Laureate...
Children's Laureate.
Children's Laureate. Had you already on YouTube or...
No, because that was 2000 and... Well, I was Children's Laureate 2007 to 9. I think the only thing that was on YouTube was Bear Hunt then.
So just looking ahead now, so you're teaching now at...
I've been teaching in higher ed in universities since 1993. I've been teaching in universities. Yeah, teaching MAs usually. So what I mostly teach is either history of children's literature, some literary theory as it applies to children's literature, and then I co-devised a course which we call Children's Literature in Action, where teachers or librarians on the course who are doing an MA take books to children and find out what children make of them.
And what, okay, that's so interesting. That was sort of what I was going to ask you next. What, who do you see as the, other than yourself, you know, obviously, are the great children's writers of today?
Oh wow! I mean, we're in a golden time.
Are we?
Oh yeah. There are many writers at all kinds of different levels. You know, very comic and broad, a bit like the Beano level of kind of
Beano, which
I absolutely adored as a kid. So I admire them, and people writing very sophisticated novels of a kind that you can relate to. Thinking back to Nesbitt.
Nesbitt, the Samiad.
Yeah, exactly. So if you take Philip Pullman, for example, this is someone who writes books that adults can read without feeling in any way looked down upon, or I'm reading a kid's book. So if you take Philip maybe at one end, and then you take people, I don't need to name them, but I mean, I helped judge a competition called the Lollies, the Laugh Out Louds Award, funny books. Well, you know, they're very broad stroke. They're funny. They're about, a monster putting another monster to sleep, and plenty of bottoms and underpants and that sort of thing. And people sometimes say about children's books, they're too much of this or too much of that. Well, they're not, because if you want to read all the classics, whatever, you just name a classic, Peter Pan, Emily and the Detective, Treasure Island, they're all available. So any book that you read as a child, bar some, some obscure ones, mostly you can get them. And as I say, you can scour the eBay and Abe Books and find these things.
Are you basically optimistic then about books and people's ability to carry on reading with the onslaught of the visual internet being thrown at them?
To be honest, I'm agnostic. I really do not know. I put myself in, say, the shoes of an 8-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
So 8-year-olds, most of them, can read, but it's quite difficult for an 8-year-old to lift expression, feeling off the page. If it says, get out of here, he said angrily, then I see angrily before I finish reading, get out of here. So I go, get out of here, excuse me, get out of here, he said angrily.
Yeah.
And I lift the expression off the page,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. For 7-8-year-olds, it's quite difficult to do. On the other hand, if they watch a video of me going, get out of here, he said angrily, well, I've done the work, haven't I?
Yeah.
So, we have to acknowledge that.
Yeah.
That the moving image and sound enables certainly that side of the word to communicate. I mean, rather weirdly, children and teenagers are probably writing more than even I ever did, because they're texting.
I've never looked at it.
So
that.
It's rather strange, isn't it? I see 10-year-olds coming out of school going with their thumbs.
Yep.
Well, I mean, they used to bust their guts, as my dad would say, to try and get us to write outside of homework.
Write the thank you letters.
Thank you letters. And they're writing, and teenagers, unbelievable amount of time they're spending texting to each other. And you think, well, isn't that extraordinary? So the written word that should be dead. Now, somebody showed me the other day the way you can now, of course, do
voice.
You voice into your phone and get the message. Well, you still got to read it. So even that, I don't know. I think it's an interesting and amazing transitional point, possibly analogous to the inventing of the printing press. By 1550, there are Bibles in every church instead of just careful manuscripts, and suddenly people were selling street literature, so they were selling ballads, as you see with Autolycus in As You Like It, selling street ballads to ordinary people, and people reciting them, and can I have that ballad about, a dragon and something, that sort of thing. So we're at a very interesting moment when the relationship between the oral and the written is going through a big change. So I can't possibly predict, but I think it's very interesting, and I'm in there with my welly boots on all those platforms, because that's what interests me. So I'm making videos, I'm texting, I'm using the internet to read books, I'm reading books, I'm writing books, I'm buying books, I'm borrowing books. So I live in all those spheres.
Well, what an absolutely fantastic place to end. Michael Rosen, thank you so much for such a fascinating conversation.
Thanks very much, Charlotte. Thank you.
You've been listening to me, Charlotte Metcalf, talking to the childhood writer, poet and author Michael Rosen. If you've enjoyed listening to us and would like to hear more conversations like this, please go to theoldie.co.uk, where you'll also be able to subscribe to the magazine. My thanks again to you, Michael Rosen, to Baillie Gifford Actual Investors for sponsoring us, and to you for listening. Goodbye. This week's podcast was kindly sponsored by Baillie Gifford, actual investors who take a long-term approach to investing in exceptional companies.